You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 506. The only safe thing is to take a chance. Mike Nichols.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer, director, producer, Rebecca X. Rice. And she is the creative force behind the new film, What Breaks the Ice. And I wanted to have her on the show, not only to talk about her new movie, but also her experiences in the film business. She happened to be the assistant to the late, great Jonathan Demme. Her films have played at South by Southwest, the Toronto Film Festival, and many other festivals around the world. She also had the opportunity to be mentored by friend of the show, Richard Linklater, and that experience and what she pulled from that. And she was pretty fascinating to talk to. We had a fantastic conversation. And I think you're going to pick up a lot of little knowledge bombs that were dropped in this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Rebecca X. Rice. I'd like to welcome the show, Rebecca X. Rice. How you doing, Rebecca?
Good. I'm so grateful to be here. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Oh, thank you so much for being on the show. I truly appreciate it. I did get to see your wonderful new film, which we're going to talk about a lot more in the show. What Breaks the Ice, last week, right before I broke my ankle.
And we'll get to joke about the fact that that really did happen.
So everyone listening, I don't publicly say these things, but I was literally walking to my office 20 minutes before the interview. I literally break my ankle. And I just got What Breaks the Ice. I just got the connection with that. Jesus.
That's pretty funny.
It is pretty funny. And I had to cancel our conversation, but I'm glad we're able to do it a week later. And now I am healing up, but it is those things that does, it actually happens. It's kind of like I saw a video of a dog eating homework. Like literally saw the dog eating the homework. It was pretty, the kid came out crying. He ate my homework. So let's get started. How did you get started in the business?
Well, actually, I kind of have, it's pretty cliched. I would actually say, let me start with where I started wanting to be a filmmaker, which was that when I was pretty young, I used to be that kid that stole my dad's video camera when we were on family vacations. And, I think a lot of kids that decide that they want their career to go in this direction, become fascinated with it at a young age. I went to a film summer camp, which I later found out our cinematographer, Greta Zozula, as well, went to the same program that I did. And we like developed our love of of telling stories with cameras. My first job, actually, what I would consider telling stories for an audience other than my family, was at Forbes.com, where I was a writer and producer for the news. Mm-hmm. And the whole world of internet video was very new and different, and we were figuring out what to do with it. And it gave me a platform to experiment, and I was very grateful for the people that gave me that opportunity.
That's pretty awesome. And you also had a chance to work with the late, great Jonathan Demme. What was that like? I mean, working with, he was a master. He was an absolute master. And not only just, I mean, obviously we could all look to Silence of the Lambs and some of his other films, but Married to the Mob and so many other films that don't get as much spotlight on. He was wonderful, wonderful filmmaker. So how did you get involved with Jonathan?
I got involved with Jonathan. I'd worked as an assistant in the Hollywood game for about 7 years out in LA, after going to graduate school at USC. And my last job out there for a stint was working at Denovi Pictures. Wonderful opportunity. I really learned the world of development and how a movie goes from beginning to end through both the independent world and the studio system. I wanted to move back to New York. I wanted to get into learning how to be a director in my own right. And I felt that my previous job experience was parlaying into that opportunity. And I had a really great friend, Courtney, who I had met actually doing a short film in Oklahoma, which was my student thesis film as a graduate student. And she called me up and she said, I think there's a job opening for a movie. I don't know who it's for, but I think it might be something that would be great for you because it's actually for a director and it would be like the proper next step for you. And I ended up going and meeting Jonathan Demme. And
what year was that? What year was that? So
this was in 2014.
So yeah, he's definitely Jonathan Demme at that point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have a very vivid memory of this. I didn't know who I was going to meet until the day of the interview. And one of the producers of the film emailed me and was like, we got your resume and will you come in and meet with Jonathan? And I was like, oh, I guess this is the movie I'm meeting on. This is crazy. And I show up on set and there is Jonathan in a bright orange sweatshirt. And he runs down the hill and he goes, hi, are you Rebecca? And I'm like, why do you know who I am? I know who you are. We subsequently have this wonderful conversation. He introduces me to several of the producers beyond the one who had spoken to me. And here I am on the set of Ricky and the Flash. And I get a phone call the next day that I get to work for Jonathan. And it kind of set off a really wonderful chain of events for me to ultimately make this movie happen.
So what was the, I'm assuming you got to see him work. What were some of the things you saw that you've incorporated or borrowed for your own style of directing?
Become friends with your actors, listen to them. I think a lot of directing, you know, there was a, I don't want to get too into the weeds of the way that the role of the director, I think, has changed. Mm-hmm. However, the one thing I always took away from watching Jonathan do his craft was that he just was so generous with all of the creative people that he worked with and had such great enthusiasm for what people were able to bring to the process. And clearly by the time I got to meet him, he was a master. However, I never saw him lose his enthusiasm for what other people could bring and what their creativity could contribute to the project. And so going into my first film as a director, I thought, well, these are all people who have great talent. I'm so grateful to have them be part of my process. How can I encourage their creativity? And what I found was through, as best as I could, generosity of spirit really helped get the best out of everybody and ultimately made the product better and the movie better.
I've noticed that with many of the directors I've had the pleasure of talking to, some of them very accomplished, the best ones are very collaborative. The image of the monocle with the blowhorn and that image of like a Cecil B. DeMille or whoever it was back in the 30s, that's not what the greats do. Generally speaking, some are different. Obviously, everyone has their own path. But generally speaking, you're right. It's like that collaborative work with everybody, the DP, production designer, actor specifically. How do you approach pulling performances or molding performances from an actor? Let's say you're not getting what you are wanting, but they're giving you something else, and it's not exactly the exact thing that you're looking for. How do you approach that?
Through questions. And I have, and I think especially on this film, on What Breaks the Ice, I have the privilege of saying that because I wrote the script, I can ask the question of, well, do you think maybe you could try doing it this way? Because when I wrote the scene, I was thinking about the character thinking about it this way. There's a particular scene that is cut out of the movie, but it was a great scene, but it's not in the movie, unfortunately, for many reasons. Not because it isn't a great scene, just because it didn't seem to fit in. Mm-hmm. But I remember directing it, and I went up to all of the actors because they were having so much fun doing what they thought the scene should be. And I said, can you please remember what point in the script we're at right now? And they go, oh, yeah. Sorry, we forgot.
But that's your job as a director, is to kind of bring.
Of course, absolutely. But you know, when you're behind the camera and you really want to elicit honesty, especially right. with young actors, and I think that's the privilege of working with young actors is that they are so talented, they're so passionate, they are so visceral. And you want to let them give you what they get off the page. So I didn't want to be too controlling. But then I said, can we just go back to where the scene is? Can you guys just try to rein it in? And they were like, oh, yeah, I'm so sorry. You're right. That was like it was around the second take.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm lying. I'm lying to myself. It was around the fourth take.
So it's, well, sometimes it is herding cats. I mean, it's kind of like you're trying to make, especially with a bunch of young actors. I've had the pleasure of working with young actors as well. And I always find it interesting as a director when you're working with young actors, because you obviously remember when you were young. I remember when I was young. It's a completely different world now. Young actors have things and are dealing, well, young people in general are dealing with things that social media, are you kidding me? I would have.
Oh yeah.
Thank God there's no social media when I was coming up. God knows what would be on the internet. The dumb things I did when I was in high school and so on. So there's certain things that they bring. Do you, it's a fine balance, because especially when you write young characters, it's a fine balance between letting them bring what their experience of being a young person is in today's world, even though you wrote it, I'm assuming using yourself as what you thought you were when you were younger. At least that's what I do when I write. I was like, yeah, a young person is a young person, but there's definitely different forces against, that put pressure on those young. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, it was actually, I completely agree with you. It was a lot of fun. I was 15 in 1998. What we had, the most fun conversations for me were how much the actors related to the story and then the things that they didn't relate to about the story at all, where there were no cell phones. I mean, I had a cell phone, I guess, when I was 17, after I, you know, got my driver's license and my parents would let me borrow their Nokia phone when I went out to the movies with my friends. Sure. Right. We were on AOL and AIM and we had the internet, but you know, but I also had the experience of going away to sleepaway camp where there was no such thing as technology from, you know, starting around the age of 9 and a half. And so I would also talk to the actors about this really was an experience for teenagers, not much younger than you. And I want you to understand that that was a reality. At the same time, they had their own experience of kind of summer camp making the film. So it was a very reciprocal experience where, sure, they had their phones and they were able to access technology. It was, you know, 2018. Mm-hmm. But yes, it was a very interesting experience to explain to them that this actually was a teenage reality not that long ago.
Right. Exactly.
And I think is pretty thematic for the film, which is also why, you know, some of the conversations I've been having about the film recently are, well, was the choice to make it a period piece important, which it was? Also, why didn't you make it so blatantly obvious that it's a period piece? And I said that I kind of want the viewer to enter the story and not know until they know through a scene about 20-ish minutes in where you have this conversation about Monica Lewinsky. And right. Suddenly you say, oh, this is a period piece. I didn't know if I was watching something that took place now or not now.
Yeah, I mean, because there's definitely places in the world that look like, I mean, look, I was house hunting recently, and trust me, there's things that are stuck in the 80s.
How do you think we found our locations?
I mean, pristinely stuck in the 80s, not touched the thing. I'm like, whole or in the 80s or 90s, like just stuck there, pristine. And I'm like, wow. So yeah, there's definitely places that people live in. I mean, I did for the longest time in LA. My house was definitely, let's say, early 2000s with 90s references. A lot of gold trimming.
Absolutely. The location that is Sammy's house, that landline phone really was on the wall. I didn't put it there. You know, that old stove, that fridge. Yeah. It was real. Our production designer, Megan, who's incredibly talented, she's my business partner in this film. She's the first person who came on board with us. But she goes, this is the best location I could possibly ask for because I can invest my efforts in the other things that we need to design because there's actually a landline phone already here. You know, so to your point, a lot has changed and a lot has not changed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I still remember I was walking by a store in LA and it was like I don't know if they call it an antique store, but it was like some sort of vintage shop. And there was a rotary phone in the window. And my daughters just turned to me and was like, Dad, what's that? So that's a phone. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, I went in and I started cranking it. And you're like, it wasn't even the push that. And they just looked at me like I had three heads. It just couldn't comprehend. And it's like, you know, for the younger people listening, privacy was how long the line was that you could buy for your land. So you could take that line around. And they sold, 100 footers? I mean...
Oh yeah, you had to get a phone line that was long enough for you to take it from the living room into the bathroom
or a closet.
or a closet to have a private conversation. Otherwise, somebody was going to be overhearing you. So,
that must have been a heck of a conversation to have with your actors about technology and just like all of that stuff. It's like, you know, I'm a bit older than you. I'm a couple of years older than you, just a couple. but it's so different. Even late 90s is vastly different. The internet, like I was there when the internet was coming up. I remember I was in college in the late 90s, and AOL, you'd get those discs in the magazines, so you get that 30-day free AOL, and that was the only connection you had to the internet. It was insane. But anyway, we're going off the deep end. Yes. I'm sorry. It's just
it's okay.
Sorry.
I enjoy talking.
Bunch of some old folks just talking about the good old days without Facebook.
Pretty much.
Now, you also had the pleasure of getting mentored by Richard Linklater, who's a friend of the show, and I love Rick. Rick is when I spoke to Rick, he is a true artist. Like there's just not even a question. He is a true artist. He approaches everything as a true artist. What were some of the lessons you took away from that experience working with Rick or having him mentor you in that program?
Well, I will echo what you just said, which is that Rick is truly an artist and also such a tremendous supporter of other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that going back to even what I said about Jonathan, I think that what I witnessed about Rick in my many interactions working adjacent to him, having him support this project, is just someone who loves what he does and wants to support other people who have the same passion that he does, which is to tell great stories. The way that it was kind of a circuitous process with him. He was always, like Jonathan, one of my most favorite filmmakers. I actually often say that the very beginning of this project was that I went to see him do an early screening of Boyhood at the IFC Center. And I think that movie is a total masterpiece. And he was talking about, you know, how he came up with the idea and how that project came to fruition. It's
insanity. Pure insanity.
Insanity genius.
Yes, yes. Right?
And I thought to myself, what would girlhood look like to me? Mm. And that's how I started writing this film. And then, you know, 5 years later, or was it, I guess, let me do the math again. 4 years later, having the opportunity to meet him in person as a mentor to this project, through the artist intensive through the Austin Film Society, where I had earned a grant that supported the movie. And it was a cool opportunity. We just did the thing that artists dream of doing, which is we went out to his beautiful ranch and mm-hmm. we had other filmmakers like James Ponsold and Athena Sangari and Jay Van Hoy, who's a brilliant producer, be there to support us and talk about how I could take my script from something that is an idea and a dream and something I want to do to through another draft and then ultimately taking it out in the world and raising money to get it made. And I think that what's really special about those experiences, if you're fortunate enough to have them, which I am, and I consider myself very blessed for that experience, is that you feel the community embracing you. And I think that the film community can feel very welcoming and also feel there's a tremendous amount of rejection. right. And so when you finally have, when you have an experience that feels warm and nurturing, it gives you the energy and the enthusiasm to believe in yourself, which is incredibly difficult.
Oh my God.
And that was what my experience was, getting to meet Rick and have him be involved in this movie. So,
I mean, we get rejected so often in this business and we get beat up so often in this business. Like I always tell people, the thing is, we're all going to get punched in the face. We all still get punched in the face. I don't care who you are. You could be Steven Spielberg. Yeah. punches come towards you. Now, whether you know that you're in a fight is one thing. You know, it's like some people don't even know punches are even a part of the game until they get knocked out and then they're out forever. And as you get older and as you go through you start learning how to take a punch and keep moving forward. You learn how to duck a couple. You learn not to even be there. You might not even in the room. Sometimes those are things you learn along the way. But we're so abused as artists in this business that I can only imagine when you have like an idol of yours invite you over to their amazing ranch and you get to work and be creative and work with others. It must not feel real. It must be like, wait a minute, there's a punch coming somewhere. Where is the punch going to come from? It's going to come out of the woodwork. I'm waiting for it, but the punch doesn't come because it's such a weird place having a nurturing filmmaking experience. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big fan of exercise, not only because it's good for your mental health, but also because you're always challenging your body to roll with things when it feels too difficult to keep going. And I think that, yes, like you're saying, I think that making films, being an artist can feel that way. I'm a skier. Mm-hmm. I've been skiing since I was a little kid. And I liken it to when you squat down and put your poles behind you and the wind is just blowing in your face and it's like stinging you, but you're moving at such a momentum and you're like, I got to keep going, even though it's really hurting me. And same with, I would say, skiing a mogul field where your knees are killing you and you're like, I'm going to get to the bottom of this and it's going to feel so good. And I think that sometimes sticking with artistic endeavors can feel the same way. I would also say that sorry to take a pause on this.
Sure, no, go for it.
I have something to say about that. I also think that we have to think about why we're doing it. And it isn't just about fame or fortune or anything else, because that actually was something that I didn't get into doing this from at the beginning. It was because I was so moved by humane stories and the really great people that I admired and then ultimately had the wonderful fortune of meeting, working with, mentoring me. It actually, to me, felt like it was important for the future of storytellers and why we're here and trying to understand who we are. And the more that I tuned into that message and the less that I focused on all the other stuff, the more that I was able to move ahead.
So Rebecca, you're telling me that filmmakers aren't rich and famous. Is that not the reason to do this?
I am definitely not rich. Sorry. I don't want anybody to think.
I mean, isn't it supposed to be you get out of film school, they give you $10 million, that's your first starter movie, then you get $100 million to do I think they bring the truck full of money and they just dump it in your Hollywood Hills mansion. No, is that not the way it works? And you Scrooge McDuck, and then you Scrooge McDuck through the dollars in your pool?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the truck to arrive. It's been about 12 years.
I'm waiting for them to return the phone call, let alone the truck.
I'm waiting for the truck of money.
There's
so making me laugh. But sometimes you have to. You have to laugh.
Because it's so painful. And look, when you were in film school, and you went to a wonderful film school, when I went to my film school, no one told me the realities of what this business was like. No one. They teach you the fluffy, like, oh, look, there's Steven Spielberg. And oh, look, there's Hitchcock. And oh, look, there's George Lucas or Coppola or any of these people. And like, oh, look, that's what directing is. And they didn't tell you that those are the exceptions. Those are the masters. Those, and in all of them, every one of those names I just laid out had a struggle to get to where they were. Not one of them just walked in and goes, oh, you shall direct. It doesn't exist. But no one ever tells you the truth. The closest I got to the truth
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh my God. I never forget this teacher. He was a grip. I was in a grip and lighting class. And he was an older grip. He was just like, guys, I can't go today because a wave of depression has hit me. I have a job next week. And this wave of depression, and he just kept using the term wave of depression. And that was the first inclination that things weren't as rosy as the brochure said. And he could just tell, that he just had shrapnel, lots and lots of shrapnel. And I want to ask you, I come from, I'm a Latino man. And I've had my struggles as a director, especially in the 90s, where if you even had a Spanish speaking person in your commercial reel, you couldn't do English because they're like, oh, he only does Spanish, stuff like that. You know, as a female director, and I've had other female directors on the show before, what does that path look like? And because I have to imagine the struggle on set. You know, when you've got that old grip. Who's like, who's this girl? Like, I mean, because they did it to me when I was the young guy on set. They're like, who's this kid? It doesn't know. Like, it's the set could be a rough place. Is that a fair? The rough could be.
Absolutely. So I love all the things you just said. I respond to that totally. What's funny, and I'll spend about 5 seconds on this. My mother is from South America. She's a South American immigrant to the U.S.
Okay.
Spanish is her first language. My mom's an architect. She experienced that on construction sites.
Oh, my God.
Spanish is your first language. You must, even though she's perfectly bilingual, but right. I learned a lot from her about what it felt like to be somebody who moved here when she was a teenager and didn't speak any English and had to, and doesn't necessarily look like somebody who would, I don't want to get into all of that, but she, as a female and as someone who necessarily didn't have what it looked like to be, I'm someone here who's in a position of authority. And she so therefore what I learned from her was you show up and you just be you. And even though she was someone who didn't present as what they thought was the position of power on a construction site, which is the architect who designed the project, shows up and didn't look like what the people working there thought that their boss should be. What I would then say for myself on the film set is I had a day where I think it was our first day of shooting, and I saw our first AD, our cinematographer, a couple other folks, and I was late and whatever. And I joined the meeting, and there was another crew member who was standing there, and I was like, hey, how's everything going? And he looked at me and was thinking, who is this person?
Who's this PA? Who's this PA?
Right. And I said, hi, I'm Rebecca. I'm the director. And I saw this look come over his face of, oh, okay. This 5-foot-nothing woman is here to direct the movie. This is not what I was expecting. And that was a really empowering moment for me, but also a little bit weird because I also wanted to be like, didn't you read the call sheet? But at the same time, it was a long-winded way of saying, yes, there were definitely challenges being a woman director. To go back to your previous question, I came up as what used to be called a D girl, which is has become thought of as a pejorative term, right? It's like, mm-hmm. You're basically like a development girl. It's like a mm-hmm. girl who works for producers and reads scripts. And I found it to be an incredibly educational position, But in the world of Hollywood, especially in the 90s and the early 2000s, and even way before that, actually, it was considered this position of a woman who will help get a production made, but doesn't really have any power other than to read a screenplay and decide if it's good or not. And then also to be kind of an assistant to any person that she's working for. And I did that job for about 7 years. And what to me was fascinating was that I always knew I wanted to be writing and directing, but I really wanted to understand how the industry worked. So I thought, what better way to get a job where I get all the insider scoop on how this whole industry works? Mm-hmm. And then I just jump on over as I'm moonlighting as a writer at night and trying to never sleep in order to eventually become someone who can make their own films. But in the industry, often it seems like there's this idea that there's a Grand Canyon between working in development and on the studio side and in that whole world and actually being a writer and directing. Mm-hmm. And to me, we were just all different pieces that come together to be a filmmaker.
There's so many Hollywood loves boxes and loves putting people in them. And if you're a writer, you're only a comedy writer, you're only an action writer, you're only a thriller writer, a horror guy. You know, I always use the example of Wes Craven, you know, who's one of the most famous.
Oh, yeah.
One of the most famous horror directors of all time. And he, you know, because I actually was one of my best friends was his personal assistant. So I would hear all the stories of Wes. He's like, Wes doesn't want to do another Scream. He doesn't want to do another Nightmare on Elm Street. He wants to do something else. So in order for Miramax at the time to get him to do Scream 2, they gave him Music of the Heart with Meryl Streep.
I remember that movie.
And it was 500. Yeah, 500 Violins.
Yeah, when you saw it, you're the first thought that could come to your head is this a joke?
That this is did Wes? It's like Alfred Hitchcock doing Dumb and Dumber. Like it doesn't. Though I would be interested in watching that. but he was caught in that box, and it was a beautiful movie. I love that movie. But it didn't do business. So because it didn't do business, he got back in your box, and he was there for the rest of his life. So Hollywood loves putting people in boxes, and everyone listening needs to understand that. Like, it's just the way it is. Like I was saying earlier, if you have Spanish on your reel as a director, that's all you could do. If you don't have anyone speaking on your commercial reel, you obviously can't direct people who could speak. Like, it was madness. It's madness, but it's a way to protect themselves, and it's either on the agency side or the studio side. Everyone's always covering their own ass, and everyone's always trying to protect themselves because they're only one bad mistake from losing their job. And that's why there's no risk. That's why there's no creativity. There's no, you know, there's no new material coming out. We all keep remaking the stuff from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, right? So, and then we're stuck in the indie world, which is great, but the budgets aren't this nice.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Which brings me to another question. How did you get this project off the ground? How did you get the financing for it? Because it doesn't have a superhero in it. You know, it's not based on a book about a wizard. So how did this get financed?
Well, going back to... I'm sorry. I thought there was a wizard in this.
Did I not see the right movie? They sent me the wrong link.
So I mentioned earlier, I have a good friend, Megan, who's a production designer. We had met when I was a graduate student at USC, and I actually started out before I always wanted to be writing and directing, but I was also doing a lot of work in the art department. And I hired her to be my art director on a thesis film that I was doing for one of my friends at USC. And I, in the meanwhile, was telling her about my thesis film that I was going to be directing and producing in Oklahoma called Noodling, which was a self-financed project and that I raised the money for and also gotten some grant money from USC. And it was based on an article I read in the New York Times about basically hand fishing, which is what noodling is. And when you're a girl from Great Neck and Long Island and you've never done anything.
There's no noodling in Long Island.
Yeah, outdoorsy aside for playing tennis. You're like, this is really exciting. So I ended up making this film. She came with me and she was the art director on the film, and we ended up just staying good friends. And she was working on lots of different projects in LA. And we had always talked about doing a feature together. And I sent her an early draft of the script, and she said that she had access to financing for people that were, it was more either gap financing or people looking to put first money into movies with the understanding that that wouldn't be the only money. Mm-hmm. And we decided, you know, we've made a good team on various short films and really low budget independent films. Why don't we try to get a feature off the ground? And so using the first money that we were able to raise, we hired a casting director. We hired a producing team in New York, where we knew we wanted to shoot the movie. And then we went pretty wide with it and just, and it was a very tandem process of bringing talent on board and also continuing to raise money. And we became one of those very lucky stories where you get great, where it just kind of snowballs, where you get good talent on board. And as good talent comes on, more money comes on, and we raised enough money to shoot the movie. And then we kept raising more money. So and then we also had a very special partnership that one of our executive producers who eventually came on hooked us up with Goldcrest Films, which is a really wonderful production, post-production house. They also do sales and distribution for independent films. And they really believed in this movie. And whereas the, you know, production can feel like such a chaotic process, they were able to help us really streamline post and sales and distribution. And that helped us get to where we are now, which is to be with our distributor and to be out in the world and to allow me to have conversations with people like you.
So. Oh, that's awesome. That is definitely a Pollyannic version of what most independent films, and there's a lot of pain in that. And there's a lot of pain in that conversation that you didn't say about, I'm sure, but yes. It was wonderful. But it's a wonderful, it's nice to hear stories like that because we need to hear them. We don't hear them very often. I hear the story of, we wrote the script and scene.
I left out a lot of details.
But oh yeah. I'm sure there was some valleys in there, not all just uphill.
Yeah, it was hard. You know, I've read a lot about other endeavors that you have. And I think that a lot of putting everything of yourself into something creative requires a dedication from your soul about how you have to just put yourself in it and believe in it. And there was a Fleetwood Mac is one of my favorite bands. Mm-hmm. And there's their song Over and Over I listen to in the shower every morning for about 5 months, over and over for about four times. And then I would say, okay, now it's time for me to get out of the shower and start my day because I feel that I've
cleansed. Just
over and over and over, all of the things that are hurting me, that are scary, that are painful, that I don't want to face, that I'm feeling scared about or wondering if I made the most horrible decision of my life, which is to invest so much in making this film and in my career generally, because I didn't just wake up one day and decided I wanted to write and direct a movie. This was the culmination of actually 20 years of my life. So I would just say to myself today, I'm going to go do it over and over again and hope the outcome is good.
And I think that's a great theme song for many filmmakers over and over again, over and over again. And I want everyone listening to understand that no matter who you are and how big you get, you're always chasing the next project. You're always chasing the next budget, the next financing. Unless your name is Chris Nolan, you know, Coppola just came out and he's like, I'm just going to put $100 million of my own wine money into my opus, because nobody wants to finance this film, and I'll put my and I was like, he's 82. God bless him. God, it just gave me such a warm feeling. You know, I pray I could get him on the show one day to just say thank you for, you know, because most men of your age, directors of your age, they just, I'm like, I'm good. I'm done. I directed Godfather.
Just quit.
You're done. You're done. You did Godfather 1 and 2, let alone Apocalypse Now and a million other ones you did, but you don't need to prove anything, Francis. But he's an artist, and he will always be an artist, and that is that spirit that soul that you were talking about. And I also wanted to ask you, cuz I got this a lot when I was coming up. The first time director thing. Did you get the first time director conversation? You're like, oh, you're a first time director. We can't give you millions of dollars or anything to make this film. You also don't have any major movie stars in this. How are we going to get this done? Did you have to run up against that? I know writing helps a bit. When you're the writer, it helps a bit. But what was your experience with that?
Absolutely. Ran up against that. I also heard you need to hire this cinematographer or this. You need this actor. Everyone involved in this movie, I could recognize immediately, was so incredibly talented and was who I wanted to do it. And I was very fortunate that I could agree for them to work with me. Absolutely. Of course you run up against that. I mean, it's impossible, right? At the same time, I have found that if you have tremendous conviction in your beliefs and you actually, you really stand up for what you believe in, people will actually get behind you if you believe in yourself.
Right.
When I know that sounds like a very cliche, but
it's the truth.
One of the most important meetings that we had around this movie. I mean, we had several important meetings as far as financing was concerned, but I can pinpoint one in particular where I was in a room with 15 people and I gave a very impassioned speech about why we needed to make this movie with the team that we had and why we needed to do it now. And the person who was in charge, a man older than me, he said to me, I get it, Rebecca, and I hear you. I understand you're this close. And then later that day, we heard that they had agreed to come on board and we were going to be able to greenlight the movie. And that, again, not to your point of sounding Pollyanna-ish, because it was not Pollyanna-ish, the process. But I found that if I wasn't completely forthright and I didn't put everything into this, I recognized that it wasn't going to happen. And I also and speaking of, you know, the things that we do for self-care and to calm our minds and to say, okay, if this doesn't happen, I'll be okay. Was I used to also play this game of, well, what if this doesn't happen? What if I put 150% into this and it doesn't happen? What will I do? And I had my backup plans of all the things that I was going to do if I couldn't get this to happen for me and for our team. And having that peace of mind actually, I think, helped me have brutal confidence in this, because I wasn't afraid if it failed. And then I think it did, and then it didn't fail. So here we are.
And it's wonderful that you say that, because, you know, and this only comes with age, unfortunately. I wish I would have learned this when I was 20. But that when you put yourself out there and you are, if you're honest and true to what you're trying to be as an artist, the story you're trying to tell, the project you're trying to get. If you're truly being authentic, people sense it. People around you, your crew, financiers, distributors, the audience, all feel that authenticity. Whereas if you walk in half foot out the door, you can't go halfway. You have to go 100%. You've got to kind of burn the ships at the shore to a certain extent. You had backup plans, but you have to burn that ship. You have to, because it's just too hard. And there's another, I'm sure that when you were in that meeting with 15 people, there was probably another 10 projects in the waiting room. And if they would have come in more if you would have gone in half-ass, you would have never gotten it. And that's something that they don't teach you at film school. They don't teach you these things.
That's very true. You know, I as we both can relate to about film school, I will say I met some of the best people that I've ever met in the world in film school.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
And I had, those were honestly like the so best years of my life.
So much fun. So much fun. So much fun.
And I watched movies I wanted to watch.
Yep.
So I wake up today and that's all I'm supposed to do today is
watch movies.
And one of my absolute favorite classes I took at USC was a David Lynch seminar. And it was so perfectly scheduled. It was Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. There's nothing weirder than going in and watching a David Lynch movie at 9 o'clock in the morning. And then walking outside, I just watched Wild at Heart at 9 in the morning. I don't even know what to do with the rest of my day.
It's like taking shots at 9 in the morning.
Yeah, you're like, I think I'm drunk, but also it's now. Yeah, right. So, and then I wrote a 10-page, and speaking of like having gone to college where I was like an art history and English major, you had to write all these intense papers. I got to write a thesis paper about Mulholland Drive and Sunset Boulevard. And
oh, it was the best.
What could be better? So I loved film school for that. At the same time, I agree with you. When you don't get to wake up at 9 in the morning and watch Straight Story.
Seven Samurai or
whatever, yeah. Right? Right. So
Criterion Collection, of course.
Right. So when actually then suddenly they toss you to the wolves and they say, okay, well now go do it. And now you're waking up at 7 a.m. because you've got to go sit at a desk and roll calls and read scripts. And it's so vastly different. Right.
I'm just going back. I'm back.
I'm giving
flashbacks. I'm sitting in my studio apartment in Orlando, Florida, where I went to film school at Full Sail, and yeah. I'm sitting there, and I worked at a video store for 4 years prior, so I brought up with me 400 VHS tapes, and I would just sit between classes at home before I knew anybody and just watch movies all day, doing papers on Aliens. And on like Much Ado About Nothing by Kenneth Branagh, and just sitting there doing all that. And then when you had to go work, you would go to class and play with cameras or talk about film and then profanicate about, you know, The Matrix or something like that. And it's just
the fun of it.
And that was so wonderful. But that's not life. That's not the reality of this business. That's a part of it. And watching films and talking about films and writing about films and all that, that's all part of it. But it is not the reality of, it's like going to art history class and looking at the masters and then sitting in front of a fresh canvas with some paint and going, do it.
Right. And I agree with that. And I actually am a painter, and that's mm-hmm. actually how I got into the arts very young, and have been oil. I was a visual arts minor and oil painting. And
that's awesome.
But I think that it prepared me, to use your point, oil painting prepared me for the process of making films, because you have to draw it and let it, and then you let your drawing sit, and then you do a portion of the painting, and then you let it sit, and then it has to dry, and it takes months, and it requires incredible amounts of patience, and then the rest of your week happens, and you have to have a job, and you have to work hard, and you're like, when am I going to just be able to finish my painting, you know? And then who's going to see my painting? Where is it going to be displayed? Is anyone going to like it?
Can I sell my prints?
Are people going to look at it and say, oh, I could do that. That was easy. I could do that in a weekend. And then you say to yourself, but could you? I don't know. Maybe you could. Yeah. And you have all of these thoughts about what the artistic process really means. So thank you for sharing your reflection of my process, because I know you get it.
Oh, I get it. I get it 100%. But isn't it amazing that out of all the art forms in the world, writing a screenplay and directing a movie is something that the average Joe off the street thinks that they can do because they watch movies. And we're like, you don't listen to Mozart and go, I can write a symphony. You don't go look at the Sistine Chapel and go, I can paint that. That's not something that's done. But for whatever reason, oh, I can write a screenplay or I can direct a movie. And I think there's, to a certain extent, I think Ron Howard said, is like, I think everyone can. But the difference between you wanting to and being able to is something called craft. And that's what takes time. And the one thing that he left out of that is also politics, realities of the business, other things like that that happen, that are unspoken things that happen on set, in the process, egos.
Right. Well, I think that what we can say, okay, so for example, what you just said about a symphony that Mozart wrote, mm-hmm. I can enjoy that music. That doesn't feel to me as though it's not about real life. It's an incredible symphony of instruments. I think that the reason why people are both drawn to cinema and television is, and the more further along the technology comes with cameras and with audio and our ability to listen and tell stories that feel so real, is it does feel so close to your real life that you think, oh, I could do that. I don't need to know how to play a violin to write about what it feels like to be Rebecca growing up in Great Neck, you know? Whereas, you know, these other art forms, right? The craft of storytelling is, yes, knowing how to reflect back on the human experience, but there's so much that goes deeper than that. It's the iceberg of creation, where you see on the top is there's so much else that goes into it. And I think that that quote that you gave is totally accurate. So
yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is like when you watch a beautiful movie, a masterpiece, you watch Silence of the Lambs. Let's go back to Jonathan. Yeah. You watch Silence of the Lambs, and it is a symphony. It is beautiful. It's one of the few horror movies ever to win an Oscar. Mm-hmm. The performances, the way he shot it, the storytelling, it looks effortless. It looks absolute effortless. But try to recreate that. It is so difficult to tell a story of that magnitude with those with those layers, and the layers upon layers upon layers of the characters and the subplots and the themes and the character arc. There's so much craft mm-hmm. within all, and then it's not just Jonathan. It's Anthony. It's Jody. It's the writer. It's everybody that put that whole thing together, and then it looks easy, but it's one of the most difficult things, honestly, on the planet to do, is to tell a good story. It is not easy to tell a good story, let alone just writing a good story, let alone filming it, putting it together, pacing, timing. One frame could be the difference with this or that. I mean, I remember the story of Star Wars, the first cut. Horrible. Horrendous. Horrible movie. It was dead in the water. And then they had to bring in three new editors, and George's wife, Marsha, and him sat down and recut it to the genius that it is now. But look, we could have not had Star Wars if they would have released that cut.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, and the alchemy that it takes.
Oh, the alchemy. Great
to
word.
To make it happen is.
Great word.
It's truly, it really is magic. I feel that. And I felt that. I feel that when I watch great movies, and I have actually felt it when it's happening around me with just the creative process, whether it was films I worked on or films that I directed. And when it's working, and it feels very unique, and it feels like you're actually going to put something in the world that will mean something to other people.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Now, which brings me to your film, What Breaks the Ice. What is the movie about?
Well, I mean, on the surface, I think it's certainly a movie about friendship. It's a movie about coming of age and being a teenager. It's a period piece. It's set in the 90s. I think for me, it was as much about a reflection of my adolescence as it was a reflection of a period of time where a certain type of adolescence won't exist anymore, which you and I talked about earlier.
Right.
Getting lost, kind of being untethered from the quote real world, you know, and for I think young people, that's school and the pressures of being a teenager, and the summertime is when you get to be a kid. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make a film about that. The film also takes a different turn about halfway through.
A little bit, slight turn. That's slight turn.
And for me, that piece of the story, I wanted to also tell a story about people that aren't perfect. Mm. I think that there's a very fine line between love and hate. I think that there's ambiguity in all of us. Most people are not all good or all bad. I think we're all trying to figure out who we are, and we make bad decisions. And there's a, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a, I think, a very complicated and scary relationship that happens among the three main characters. Mm-hmm. And that was something that at the period of time when the story takes place, those kinds of experiences weren't really talked about in the way that they are today.
Oh yeah. Oh God, no.
And I wanted to expose that and to show that emotion and what that experience could feel like from two teenage girls and the messages that they're receiving around them about how they should feel about those experiences.
I mean, I was the girl who was working at the tennis courts, but I was the guy. I was the one who wasn't the, I was not raised rich. I was middle class all the way, but I was lucky enough to go to a really good private high school. And that's where I met some of my good friends who were that other level of sophistication, of, you know, being rich and things like that. So I identified with her very much because you get thrown into environments that, and with people that you just, their experience is so different of life. Right. You know, I'm struggling to, not me personally, but you know, you're struggling to eat, or to get clothes that fit, or not to get hand-me-downs or something like that. And they're just talking about like, oh, you know, I was in Aspen last week, you know. It's a it's a different life experience. So I really did identify with her specifically. Yeah. It was a wonderful, wonderful film.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. I think there's a lot to uncover, and I actually am looking forward to people telling me what they think. I think that movies, my favorite movies that I've watched, the filmmakers that I enjoy, my favorite thing to do in the world is to watch a movie and then go out to lunch or dinner with the people I just watched it with and talk about how it made me feel. And I really hope that there's a conversation to be had about this film, because there's a simplicity to the plot, if you can say that. Yeah. I don't, it's there, you know, it's not like there's seven plot lines to follow here. Mm-hmm. There are characters, it's told in a certain kind of visual structure, visual language that we chose, which we was very deliberate, which it's the shots are composed in the way that they are. The editing lends itself to the way that the film was shot. It's meant to slow you down in the way that the summertime when you were a teenager in the late 90s. And what our hope was that as you lose yourself in the story of these characters, it forces you to think about their choices and ultimately the outcomes of what happened, and to think, well, it was a simple story, but it made me think about deeper things.
And that's what good art does. Definitely does. And I don't know about you, but one of my favorite things when I was coming up in my teen years is to go to a midnight movie and then go to Denny's because that's the only thing that was open. And you would sit there with your other cinephiles and explain to them why Neo is an allegory for Jesus, and this is why he's the savior, and this and Neo is really an allegory for one, and you see it's all
no, and now I'm in my late 30s, and instead of seeing Rocky Horror, I do a Rocky Horror spin class in my apartment. And think back to when I used to go to Rocky Horror showings at the Lemley in LA. And
so
now I just exercise to the soundtrack.
So before we go, I have to tell you my Rocky Horror story. So in high school, I would go to Rocky Horror with my friends almost every weekend. I must have seen Rocky Horror 30 or 40 times. I don't particularly like Rocky Horror. I just enjoy the experience with the crowd and also with my friends, because the movie itself, the music's fantastic, but the movie, I can't just sit there and watch it. Like, you just can't sit watch Rocky Horror at home. That's just weird. It's like watching it's like watching The Room at home.
I actually just was about to say it's like watching The Room by yourself. I was trying to explain to my boyfriend, who's a professor, and he's a wonderful person, but I was trying to explain to him what The Room is.
Oh, the genius of The Room? Absolutely.
Of The Room. And he just looked at me and said, "I'm sure you're right." So yes, it's the same thing.
So when I went to one day, we realized that, you remember you brought rice and toast and spoons.
Oh, of course, and you throw at the screens.
You throw at the screens and stuff, right? Yeah. So what we did one day was there was no limit to how much rice you could bring. So we we brought, with four of us, each of us brought like 40-pound bags each of rice. And when the rice scene came on, there was this this tsunami of rice. We sat in the back and it just crested over the audience, and people were like, "What is going on?" It was so the week after we went the week right afterwards, and then there's a big sign, "No excessive rice." So poor guy had to clean all that up for the next.
That's amazing. I love that.
Now, where can people see the movie?
So you can see the movie. We actually will be playing in theaters, but I'll start with the places you can stream it. So it will be on Apple TV, iTunes, Amazon, Vudu. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I can give you a full list.
Any place you could rent it, you can get it.
Basically any place that you could possibly rent a movie these days.
Mm-hmm. It'll be there.
It will be there.
Other than Blockbuster, obviously.
Yeah, we're not. I wish I could unearth Blockbuster. And
there's only that one. There's only that one in Oregon.
The one. Yeah.
I've had that filmmaker on the show, and it was fantastic.
It's pretty cool. But basically, anywhere you can rent,
it'll be available
online. It will be there, with the exception of, like, I think the only streaming services we won't be on are Netflix and Hulu yet, but we will be there.
Those are subscription-based, yeah.
Yeah. And then also, if you're a cable subscriber, any cable, every VOD. Cable subscriber will have us in their on-demand section. And then we will be in five cities. I think it's Boston, Houston, Chicago, Seattle, and the LA greater area.
Nice.
And I can share that with you.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. So don't worry about that. Now I'm going to ask you three questions to ask all my guests. Okay. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Patience.
That's mine. I'm still learning it.
Mm-hmm. Patience.
What did you learn from your biggest failure?
Sometimes the reason that you failed has nothing to do with you.
That's really good. That's a profound statement. I like that a lot because it's so true. There's so much truth in that statement. And there was one question I forgot to ask you because we went on so many tangents on this wonderful conversation we had.
And it was great talking to you.
It was a wonderful conversation. But there was one question I wanted to ask you. On the shoot, while you were shooting What Breaks the Ice, there had to have been one day that you felt the entire thing was going to come crashing down around your head. What was that day and how did you deal with it?
We were shooting one of the most important scenes on a highway that we closed down in upstate New York. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning. And there was a shot that I knew that we needed to get. And there were people that were prepared to walk away. Because we were... It was the one night specifically that we went very over. And when I had this reputation on set, which became a joke, that I was a monitor hog, which meant that my only way of being able to really direct well was I used to put my arms around the monitor so I could just see the monitor with nobody else around me. And that allowed me to not look at who else was there, even though these are all amazing, wonderful people. But if I saw how many people were there, I would be too overwhelmed to do my job. Mm-hmm. And so we had to make a decision of to do one more take, which I knew that we needed. And I suddenly looked up from the monitor and I saw 50 people looking at me on a closed off highway in the middle of upstate New York.
4 o'clock in the morning.
And I said to myself, and I saw trucks in the background and lights in the woods and actors and a truck and kids on the ground and pizza behind me. And I said, what on earth am I doing? Why am I here?
Oh, no.
Who let me do this?
We all have. And you know what? And I want everyone listening. Every director has these moments. And it could be on a $200 million project or it could be on a $2 project. A short film, a feature. You always have those moments. I always feel like security is going to come in any moment and kick me out of the party. Anytime I'm on set.
Oh yeah. And then I said, okay, we need to do this one more time. And we did it one more time and it was done and we wrapped and it was great. But it was, I think sometimes as a director, whether whether it's a five person short film you're doing with your friends as a student or a much larger project, there are definitely those moments where you look around and think to yourself, who threw this party and let me run it?
Who's directing this movie? Because it looks big. There's a lot of stuff. I wouldn't want to be that director.
So that was certainly.
I'll give you one little story before we go. When I was directing my demo reel for my commercial demo reel, I had spent $30,000 out of pocket, which I had taken a loan out from my grandpa because we were shooting on 35 that's all there was. Right. So we were shooting 35, and day one, within the first 30 minutes, my entire grip and electric walked because the DPs, if you notice, I said two. I don't know if you've ever been on a set with two DPs. That was fun. they had gear, so they had a grip truck. So that's why I hired them. Mistake one, never make that again. So my DPs were so unprofessional that the professional grip and electric crew said, we're not going to deal with these monkey DPs. And they called them the monkey DPs for the rest of the 3 or 4 days that we were shooting. And they walked, and my producer had to like bring back her brother, who was the key grip, who then brought the rest of them. This is day one of my shoot, of my big shot as a director to start my directing career.
Wow.
That's where I came from.
Oh my goodness. That's a lot. I mean, and that's day one. I'm talking about, I think, day 14. So no,
this is day one.
I have a lot of sympathy for that.
30 minutes in. It wasn't like halfway in. 30 minutes in. They're like, these guys obviously are monkey DPs. We're not going to work with these people.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God. It was amazing. Last question. Three of your favorite films of all time.
Okay. So they're going to be kind of all over the board.
That's fine.
I'm going to mention one first that I saw recently, which was Another Round, Thomas Vinterberg's movie. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loved that film. It was one of my favorite movies that I've seen probably in the last 5 years. Second would be Dazed and Confused, not to go back to Richard Linklater, but yeah. That is a movie that I have probably seen 15 times.
All right.
Love that movie so much because I don't know what it is that draws me in about, again, like simple story, but
it's authentic.
It's just so, you feel so much for those characters, and there's so much emotion that's brought through in that film, even though it's so simple in mm-hmm. certain ways. And then, of course, I'll mention the film that made me want to be a filmmaker, which is Days of Heaven.
Oh, Malik.
The film that I saw at that film summer camp when I was a young person. And I was blown away that you could film a whole movie during magic hour. And it just completely blew my mind.
Because it's Terrence Malick. That's why. Only he could shoot 15 minutes a day and get away with it.
Yeah, I know, right? And that's, but I also feel, those are three movies that I think I can immediately mention that are just three films that have like recent, present, past. But I also want to mention, I think that Celine Sciamma, who's a female director, is someone who I'm so inspired by her and the storytelling that she does. And I think that there is a really cool moment we're living through right now where female storytellers are really having an opportunity to become auteurs. And that's something that sometimes I think was, I mean, there are so many wonderful female filmmakers like Agnes Varda and who have inspired me. But what I wanted to say about her is that she's kind of coming into this place of being a female auteur in a way that a lot of the auteur filmmakers that I greatly admire inspired me. And I look forward to what the future holds.
It's an exciting time, and there are definitely a lot more voices being allowed. There a lot more voices are getting the keys to the car, as I always say, mm-hmm. which is I can't even comprehend. I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, Robert Rodriguez is the first Latino filmmaker I knew. It was just Robert, and I was like, wait a minute, if Robert could do it, I was in high school when that came out, so I was like, oh, it was Robert. So like, as a female director, I can only imagine. I mean, you had Catherine Bigelow, you had Jane Campion.
Jane Campion's another favorite.
I mean, she's amazing. But
yeah, and it was also one of my favorite films. And
but they would get chances every once in a blue moon, you know. Yeah. Or Sofia Coppola would come out, you know. But once in a blue moon, they would get their shot. It's really amazing what's happening now, and they're more interesting movies being made, I think, you know, when they're given the opportunity to do so. Females, people of color, you know, just it's just representative of the world that we live in. So I think that's what's so wonderful. Thank you, Rebecca, so much for being on the show. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We could still, I'm sure we could geek out, continue to geek out for quite some time.
I truly appreciate it. It was a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for having me. And the last thing I'll say, if you have 30 more seconds,
sure.
And this is something that's personal to me. When you asked about advice, I try not to make this the centerpiece, but I would, another piece of advice that I would give to people is that I went through a really bad, horrible tragedy while I was finishing my film.
Oh, wow.
And I think that sometimes we forget as filmmakers that life will get in our way while we're pursuing our dreams.
Oh.
And I think that there's we need to also respond to ourselves as human beings and recognize that life will happen while you're in your valiant pursuit of being an artist, and to just take time for yourself and then to keep going, because that's the best way that you can honor your art and your passion, and also honor the people that you lose, is to keep going with what you have to give to the world.
And I think also everyone listening needs to understand, by the way, that was very beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, you know, we're making movies, not curing cancer. So, and I think sometimes we get a little too uppity about what we do. And don't get me wrong, stories are very important, but let's put things in perspective. I know it means everything to you, but do it right. Take care of yourself. Take care of the people around you who are working with you. Make it an enjoyable experience. And if you're not enjoying yourself on set and not enjoying the process, why do it? It's just too difficult. You could be off digging ditches somewhere then. You know, I always tell people, anytime someone gives me attitude on set, I'm like, we could be digging a ditch somewhere. We are so lucky to be on set right now. And that someone is paying us to do this is remarkable. So take it, just be very grateful, and grateful is the best word I could use, that we get to do what we get to do. We have fun. We get paid to have fun for a living. I just wish it was more often. We spend 95% of our lives working to make 5% of the movies we want, because it takes so long, right? It took how many years to get this movie off the ground? And then you shoot for what? 3, 4 weeks, 5 weeks?
Exactly. That's why I said patience.
Patience. Thank you again, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was so fun speaking with you. I hope to do it again soon.
I want to thank Rebecca so much for coming on the show. Thank you so much, Rebecca. I suggest that everybody go out and watch What Breaks the Ice. It is a fantastic film, and I'm glad it's out there. Thank you again so much, Rebecca. One that needed to be made. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/506. And if you haven't already, and I don't know why you wouldn't have, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast wherever you are consuming it. It really helps the show out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.